In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
If you are not there for your child, nobody else will be. So just to try to give your child the reassurance that actually it's going to be okay. Just trust me, it's going to be okay. And when you are out of this, the world will be a much, much better place. There'll be, the light will be much, much brighter. They won't believe it at the time. They won't because they'll be in such mental pain. But all you can say is look at them in the eyes and say it's going to be all right.
It's Mentally Yours from Ellen and Yvette. A focus on your mental health, you surely won't regret. It's mentally yours.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Mentally Yours, Metro.co.uk's weekly mental health podcast. My name is Yvette, and this week I'm going to be chatting to Mark Simmons. He's a father, a businessman, and now an author. We're going to be chatting to him about his new book, which is called Breakdown and Repair, A Father's Tale of Stress and Success.
I'm now 56 years old, and I'm thinking if there's one thing that I'd like to leave as a bit of a legacy, if that's not too pompous, it would be my experiences of mental ill health. Because I've been through the mill throughout my life in a couple of ways. As you say, firstly as a sufferer and then as a carer. So, and I know how important mental health is now as a topic, and it's getting on everybody's agendas. So I just feel that the more that I can come out of the mental health closet, so to speak, and share my experiences, the better for everyone.
So when did you yourself start being affected by mental illness?
Well, when I wrote the book, I realised that I probably suffered from mental ill health when I was quite young. So when I look back on things and realise experience that I had when I was sort of 15, 16, I now can see that I was quite a anxious child. I was always the person that would be in bed at 10 o'clock on exam night, not because I was complacent, but because I was always overprepared. I didn't want to leave things to the last minute. So, and again, I love sport, love playing sport, but I was not the kind of person that you'd have bet to take the winning penalty in the World Cup or serve out for the match in Wimbledon, because I was always a bit tight and tense. So I think probably it was quite early in my life, that I realised I was quite an anxious person. And again, when I wrote my book, it was possibly partly due to my mother, Alice, who was an anxiety sufferer. So she suffered from depression and anxiety. And so I think that she probably passed on her genes to myself when I was young.
So when did your anxiety start becoming an issue, a problem?
Well, I think it becomes more noticeable when you enter into the world of business, into the adult world. So when I was about 23, 24, I started my first proper job working for a company called Unilever. And I was only a lowly young trainee, so I wasn't under any amount of stress. But there was just one day when all of a sudden I was in front of my computer just getting through my to-do list, and I tried to do the next item and I simply couldn't. And I looked at the computer screen and I froze. And it was quite frightening because I didn't quite know what was happening to me. So I sort of stepped away, walked downstairs, wandered around a bit, came back to my computer, tried it again, nothing. So, and then I suddenly panicked a bit and sort of spoke to my boss. My boss said, look, why don't you go and take a week off work? And at the time, because this is back in sort of late 1990s, is that the doctor says, well, maybe you've had a little bit of a panic attack. Here we go. Here's some medication. Go away. Back to work in a week and we're good to go, really. So I think that was my first, what I call my first little blip that kind of taught me that things were not always that straightforward.
And what happened subsequently?
Well, the issue was that I was probably in the wrong job. So I think the big thing that I stress in the book is that if you're quite an anxious, stressed out person, then the most important thing is for you to try to find a working environment that suits your personality. So I was really more of an introvert. I was into helping people develop. I was moderately ambitious, but found myself in a working environment that was much more task-driven, was quite ambitious, and was full of extroverts. So it was just difficult to be at my best. So when I moved into the world of management training, that's when I suddenly realized that there could be a working environment where your personality wasn't being put under pressure every single day of the week. So that was like the big relief for me.
So beforehand, when we were chatting before the podcast, you talked about that you had a breakdown. I thought it was interesting that you mentioned that sort of phrase, because I'm not sure we hear that phrase very often. What actually happened?
Well, it's a good question, because first of all, the term breakdown, if you look in the medical dictionary, doesn't exist. So there's no definition for the word breakdown. But it was extremely real, because what happened was that after 5 or 6 years of bliss working management training, I then made this horrific decision to think that I was good enough to go into business on my own with a couple of colleagues. And I was back in the work environment full of sort of extroverts, full of people getting tasks done. So I was in the wrong pool, so to speak. And slowly over the course of about a year, a little bit like Chinese water torture, every day there was a drip, drip, drip. Every day became slightly more stressful. And over a period of sort of six to seven months, things got progressively worse. But because this was my dream, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, got to sort of make it in business, I just didn't want to give up. But unfortunately, again, one day in my home office, similar to my very first experience of having a little blip, I was there in front of my computer again. And once again, I looked at the computer and everything froze. And I said, okay, right, deep breath, downstairs, cup of coffee, back upstairs. The computer still says no, back downstairs and still nothing. So I thought, okay, well, let's just go to the doctor. And the doctor says, look, you're just a bit stressed. You're a bit overworked, 2 or 3 weeks off. And then you'll be right as rain. So that's what I did, 2 or 3 weeks off. But then when I came back to my computer, I looked at it again and still it was saying no. So fundamentally I had at that point broken down. And what's interesting about a breakdown is that actually it's a good thing, because what's happening is the brain is taking things out of your hands. It's kind of saying, look, you know, you're not fit to work, and until you're fit to work, I'm not going to let you continue. So the brain is actually telling you to stop. And at that point, I was experiencing, not unfortunately, just a panic attack, but it was like a full-on breakdown.
So when you say you were looking at the computer and the computer says no, does that mean you were sort of looking at a screen but you couldn't read the words, or what do you actually mean?
No, I could read the words. I was quite coherent. But then I said, okay, now I've got on my to-do list, say 5 or 6 things for the day. You pick up the first one and you start tapping away at the computer, but your mind is just racing with a dozen other thoughts in your head. You think about, what about those other things I've got to do on my to-do list? So it's kind of like you start things, but your head is just full of stuff. So at that point, you just can't get through the items on your to-do list. So and then what happens is you start not doing anything at all, and you start realizing you're getting behind. And as you get behind, you start to panic more and more, and you spiral and you spiral. So it just becomes worse and worse and worse. And you come back to your to-do list and still nothing there. And then you get to a point where you just stop.
Mm. Sounds like it kind of is a big sort of snowball of stress and anxiety. How did you, what sort of treatment did you get?
Well, this is now a few years later on after the sort of the little blip. So you go to the doctors and they kind of get what's happening and they diagnose that what you have now is agitated depression. So that's the depression that you get once you've basically been stressed for so long that eventually you become depressed. So you then get onto medication and the doctor then says, right, you should go to the NHS centre and get some booklets about how to cope with stress. And you're kind of being patched up a bit. So that's what it is. And go away and come back and you'll be okay eventually. So, but unfortunately, the problem was that you go away and you are broken. And the medication, if it does work, it takes sort of 3 or 4 weeks to work, but it might not work. And in my case, I just couldn't get better. And I think at the back of my head was, I've got to get better because I'm letting down my two colleagues at work. And we got mortgages, we got money, we got bills to pay. I got a family here at home. And everything in your head just is conspiring against you trying to get better. And the more that happens, the worse you become. So what the brain needs to happen to it is for it to get switched off. But you get to a point where you are panicking all the time, so you're just not giving your brain a break, and it gets worse and worse, if that makes sense.
How did you sort of break out of that cycle?
It's okay. So this is not a typical, it's not a recommended way to break out of a depression. So imagine 4 months at home, and it gets worse and worse and worse. Nothing seems to work. No medication works. No talking therapies work. I try to find a very busy road. And I find a busy road and eventually a truck comes along and the truck, you know, I throw myself in front of the truck and I suffer head injuries and a collapsed lung, but obviously I don't die. And then I get helicoptered to the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford. And this is the strange bit here. So imagine that I've been so desperately ill for about 4 months and I wake up in hospital and my wife is there with one of her girlfriends and I make a lewd joke. And it's the first time in months that I've been able to smile or laugh. And I'm not cured, but I'm just suddenly being knocked into shape. And from that moment on, gradually, I get better and better. So this is not the conventional way to get over a break.
No, it's quite different.
Not to be recommended to anyone, but this is what happened. I'm being truthful.
So how did you then go about getting back to normal life? Did you moderate it for sort of your mental health stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that's exactly what happened next. So I'd got a big shock. I'd been given a second chance, whatever you want to call it, wake-up call. And I owed it to my family to start again. So I then said, right, this is silly. You know, let's find a way of finding an occupation that is suitable to me and a lifestyle that's much more balanced. So I immediately gave up my shareholding in my company. I became a freelancer, a much more relaxed kind of lifestyle, back into training. And we just had a much more balanced life. So all the things that people talk about now around eating well, sleeping well, exercising, socializing, we just did. And sort of, you know, for a period of about 10 years, we just had a blast. So we had a decade that was just a great decade. Nothing majorly went wrong. Had a good time, had a fun time. And mentally, I was able to kind of to control things much more easily because I kind of understood really now, in a sense, the triggers that were going to send me down a wrong path.
How were your family affected by this time?
Well, my children were quite young at the point. So imagine that when I had the big blip, Jack was 2 and Emily was 5 and Will was 7. So they were relatively young. My wife, Mel, and I mean, she was the real hero because she had to put up with everything. And the difference between Mel and me is that Mel is much more, let's say, normal. She's much more level-headed. She's sort of, she's not suffered from mental ill health and has not had experience of it within her family. So she was just very stable, thank God, because she sort of helped me through the illness. So, but by the time I'd sort of got let's say, bit better Mel was just exhausted by everything, so she just needed a bit of a break. So, and I think fortunately, because we decided as a family that we had to sort of review how we lived our lives, things got back on an even keel.
And what about your work colleagues? Because it sounds like you'd got into quite a exciting to start with, and then sort of fairly serious project with a couple. Was it a couple of other friends slash colleagues?
Yes.
How did they respond?
No, I mean it was very difficult for them. I mean, horribly difficult for them. I imagine new business. You could not afford to have one of your partners being off ill. Sick.
But did you manage to kind of explain about the mental health side of things?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I mean, obviously when I took the initial couple of weeks off, I had to say this is what's happened to me. And then once I went back to work and that failed, I then said, look, I'm really sorry, but I've got to take unlimited time off work. And I could only explain to them as well as I could do what was happening. And Mel, my wife, did her best to do the same. And they were very understanding but also they just didn't have a clue kind of what was happening. And, you know, to their great credit is that they were both prepared to fund me whilst I was off work, which took pressures off my mind. But there came a point when, you know, understandably, they just needed to know, well, what can we do to move the business on? So, but I wouldn't want to wish that on anyone to have that pressure from their point of view. So it was just very difficult all round, really.
Have you managed to talk to any of your friends about the mental health side of things?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing when I suffered this sort of this big blip is that I decided afterwards that the best thing for me was to be quite open and honest about things, because it was quite a dramatic thing. I mean, I could hardly say that I'd been off work because I had a bit of a flu virus. I mean, I'd basically throw myself in front of a 10-ton truck. So it was quite dramatic. And I thought, well, the best thing to do is just be open and honest about things. And I received some great coaching from a wonderful woman called Sue Holland, who just said, look, one thing that you could do is start writing about it. So back in the day, back in sort of 2004, I put pen to paper and I wrote about 15,000 words just to try to understand exactly what had happened, why it happened. And that was very, very cathartic. So that was my way of trying to cope with things after the event, by sort of putting pen to paper.
And you recovered really well. You've been sort of changed a whole sort of working life. And you said you have 10 years of, you know, everything going brilliantly. But then you've also had the experience of looking after your daughter who suffered from anorexia. When did that start?
Okay, so basically imagine from about 2002 to 2012, the golden decade, just a great decade. And so ironically, it was 2012, the summer of the Great Olympics, when, you know, it was such a glorious summer. Nothing could go wrong. That in autumn of that year, Emily had just turned 16. She was just entering her A-levels. And one day she came back home and just said to us, look, I've got some news. I've been making myself sick. And what it transpired that it was the beginning of an eating disorder. So, and I think at the time, because we didn't really understand it, we'd had no experience of anorexia or bulimia, so we didn't quite know what it meant. We were a little bit relaxed about things, because you wouldn't look at her and say, well, there's something wrong with you. She was looked absolutely fine, and you couldn't spot any odd behaviours. So we didn't know quite what to expect. But I mean, I think 6 years later, when we were sitting in a cafe in Mallorca on a holiday, and we looked at Emily eating a plate full of food, and we just both said to her, look, we're so proud that you can eat properly again. We just realised just what would been through. So it was like 6 years later that suddenly, you know, we could honestly say maybe we had sort of got through the worst.
Mm. So it was six difficult years, basically.
Yes.
What did you do to support your child?
Okay, so I mean, the first thing is that when we realized that Emily had a problem, is that we were quite proactive. So we went to the NHS, we went to the people that looked after adolescents with mental health problems, and they were very good. So we did defer to people that knew better. And the recommendation always is that when you have somebody with anorexia or any eating disorder, is to try to manage this from the home. So Mel became a sort of full-time at-home carer, and I'd be helping out on a sort of part-time basis. But we try to manage the illness from the home. And what that means is that with anorexia is that there is this aversion to food and drink. So fundamentally that you don't want to eat or drink for fear of getting bigger. So what you have to do as a parent is that you have to supervise every single mealtime just to make sure that your child is eating everything that's put on the plate. And the reason why the supervision is so important is because if your attention is diverted for a nanosecond, is anorexia starts to play tricks. So Emily would start to sort of hide things down her cleavage. She would eat things and then be sick later on in the toilets. She would take laxatives to get rid of sort of an ounce or two. So what we found out was that anorexia was a really brutal sort of merciless enemy, and that we just couldn't afford to take our eyes off her for a second.
That must have made mealtime as very stressful.
It was, because you're sitting there and you're just looking at your daughter with the plate of food in front of her, and she's looking at the plate of food and she doesn't want to eat it, and you're desperate for her to eat it, and you're just not quite sure what to do. And then when we found out that an empty plate of food wasn't a sign that she'd actually eaten it, but maybe that she'd hidden it or had thrown it up or had fed the dog. The dog suddenly put on lots of weight beneath the table because that became a recipient of the food. You just were stressed most of the time. Yes, that's a fair point.
How did it affect the rest of your family? Because you've got a couple of other kids, haven't you?
Yes, it affected Jack, our youngest, most of all, because at the time he would have been probably about 13, so still at home. Will was a couple of years older, so he'd just got into university, so he kind of missed the bloodbath, if that makes sense. So Jack was the person that, I mean, did amazingly well, because imagine if you're 13, 14, and all the attentions with your daughter, he had to become very, very self-sufficient. So, I mean, again, it's an awful thing to say, but like most clouds have got silver linings. So now Jack is 20, but he's very, very kind of independent. He looks after himself. And part of it is because he had to be independent at the point when my daughter was very, 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 very ill.
What helped Emily in terms of her anorexia?
We had plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D. So plan A was at home and didn't work. So plan B, she then went as a sort of a day patient to a hospital in Oxford for about 8 weeks. And she tried to put on weight, tried to get better, and that didn't work. Once that didn't work, we then were not able to get Emily into a national health hospital where there were beds, because her weight wasn't low enough. So the irony is that your weight's going to be so low to get into an NHS bed, but it wasn't low enough. So we then had the choice to make, well, what do we now do? And so we had some private health funding through Bupa. So we then managed to get her into a private institution where she spent a further 7 weeks, but that didn't work either. So by not working, what I mean is she, even though you're in a private healthcare clinic and even though you've got nurses all over you, anorexia was just too strong for them all. And basically she still found ways of helping Emily hide food, be sick, not eat. So imagine 7 weeks later, comes out of a clinic, you know, the Bupa funding has run out, and no progress to be made. And at that point, the doctor at the clinic said, look, unfortunately, Emily's going to need a long 6 to 12 month stay somewhere. Because the funding was limited, we had to then look for somewhere in the NHS again. But again, the same problem arose whereby there were no beds, nothing was available. So my daughter came out of the clinic, no beds, and she stopped eating. So, I mean, I don't mean stop eating lots, I mean stopped eating. And so we had her at home, but there were no beds, and the local NHS were very, very helpful, but they said, I'm very, very sorry, but there's nothing we can do. And so what I had to do was basically get on the phone to every single NHS clinic across the country myself, just to phone up, do you have any beds, do you have any beds, do you have any beds? And everyone, I'm very sorry, but no, I'm very sorry, but no. And eventually a lovely, lovely woman in a hospital in London said, look, this is very unusual. We don't ever usually get fathers calling up. It's usually doctors. But as it happens, there is one coming up in the next couple of weeks. We can put you on the list. And then 2 weeks later, a second clinic called up. So it was a bit like two London buses where you suddenly you wait for one and then two come along. So we were given a choice and we chose the one in Oxford because it was closer. And then Emily spent 6 months in that clinic and got a lot better. She's now 18 years old, got a lot better. And she came out of that clinic after about 6 months and she was better, but not 100% better. So it's a little bit like the analogy is where you're climbing Mount Everest. You get 200 feet beneath the top of Everest. You're almost there, but you stop. And with anorexia, you can't afford to stop. That last 200 feet is the hardest 200 feet, but you've just got to go for it. Emily came out of the clinic 200 feet short. And we just didn't know. We thought, well, she's so much better now. But she came out and then still spent another 2 years as a, what we call, what is called rather, a functioning anorexic. So someone who's like, not ill, but is not better. So she was very, very limited, still very, very limited with what she ate and how she ate. So to go back to your initial question is how did she get better? With the illness, unfortunately, the patient only gets better when they want to become better. So it's a personal choice. There's no medication. You know, there's no magic bullet, there's no tablets. So when Emily aged about 19, 20, said, I've had enough of this, suddenly she started to get better. And so again, it's a little bit like with my illnesses, it's not a conventional cure, but with anorexia, it really is dependent upon the patient wanting to get better and then they get better.
Did you find it easier to support her or relate to her because of your own mental health issues?
Yeah, I think it was hard because when I saw Emily, first of all, I could see the suffering because she had depression and anxiety linked to anorexia. They often go together as mental illnesses. So when I saw her eyes and just, particularly in the first year or so, I felt so much pain for her because I could see what pain she was going through. That was the bad news. But the good news was I kind of understood what she was going through. So I could be quite empathetic. And because mental illness is not a logical illness, is that what people with anorexia don't need is rational discussions. They don't need to be told, look, if you don't eat, you're not going to have strong, healthy bones. If you're not going to eat, you won't have children. So it just doesn't help. So they just need to be talked to in a very, very irrational, almost emotional way. So what they need is plenty of listening, plenty of empathizing, plenty of hand-holding, plenty of hugging, plenty of, look, it's going to be all right. Trust me, it's going to be all right there. And that's it. And so it was, whereas with Mel, is completely, less, completely normal, much more even keeled. So her line of attack was often more rational, more logical. And so it's almost like, when she was talking rationally to Emily, Mel could have been talking Swahili almost. It just was a different language. You almost needed to speak the language of irrational, if that makes sense, because that's what she understood quite well.
What would you say to any other parents who have a child with an eating disorder?
Good question. I think first of all is to recognise as soon as possible. So that since Emily's become better, and we've had other parents who've said, look, I'm a bit worried about my child, what shall I do, you know? And I said, I think the first thing is just take it seriously. I mean, really take it seriously, that the earlier that you can actually do something about it, the better. Even if the child doesn't want to get treatment, I think it's really important to try to get to people that know better. It's such a tricky illness. By the time that we'd realized that Emily was anorexic, she'd been ill for about 6 months, you know, so we just caught it. So I think the first thing is just try to be proactive and get help. I think the second thing is to try to understand it's basically a mental illness. Although people think about anorexia as well, it's just about being thin, looking thin, it's not eating enough, but that's driven by a mental illness there. So it's to understand that it's not rational and to treat it as such. A mental illness, that's number two. I think number three is just to be patient and understand that you could be in it for the long term, if that makes sense. Or it's not necessarily going to be a quick fix. It would be much better if fundamentally you could break a leg and you had a very, very clear path to recovery. 1, 2, 3, okay, 6 months, 3 months, we're back to... But anorexia, it just goes off on its own path here. So just be a bit patient. And I think number four is the key thing is if you are not there for your child, nobody else will be. So it's just to try to give your child the reassurance that actually it's going to be okay. Just trust me, it's going to be okay. And when you are out of this, the world will be a much, much better place. There'll be... The light will be much, much brighter. They won't believe it at the time. They won't because they'll be in such mental pain. But all you can say is look at them in the eyes and say it's going to be all right. So I think that'd be the fourth thing.
So this is goodbye for mentally yours. So go away, enjoy your day, get on with all your chores. From Mentally yours.
If you've been struggling with any of the issues we've been chatting about today, please call the Samaritans. They're on 116 123. Also, you can find them online at samaritans.org. See you next week.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.